Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Just days before the Portraits of Pride exhibit on the Boston Common was set to close, several of the photographs of LGBTQ leaders were slashed. It's not an isolated incident. In August, a transgender pride flag was burned outside a church in Brookline. In July, a housing project aimed at LGBTQ seniors was defaced with homophobic language. So we wanted to take some time to dive beneath the headlines and talk about what is going on in our own backyard. Joining us here in Studio 2, three folks who were directly impacted by the Portraits of Pride vandalism. Beth Chandler is the president and CEO of YW Boston, and her photo was one of those that was defaced. Beth, welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Thanks for coming. We also have Jean Dolan, creative director of the Portraits of Pride exhibit. Jean, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Quincy Roberts, the inaugural executive director of Boston's new office of LGBTQ plus advancement. His photo was defaced when the exhibit opened. Quincy, thank you for coming as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Beth and Quincy, I'm going to start with the two of you, since your photos were both defaced at different times. First of all, Beth, you said to me in an email, not necessarily surprised that something like this was happened. Were you worried? Did you think something like this might happen?
I definitely thought something like this might happen. I thought in some ways it was inevitable given the climate that we live in. And I'll just share a story. Several years ago, I've lived in Rosendale for over 20 years. Several years ago, I was walking down my street. I passed a man. I smiled, and he said, "You don't belong here." And that just, I was horrified. And I was walking down to the park to get my kids, who at the time were in elementary, and I'm thinking, oh my God, like this person could harm my kids. And so I feel like there is often a reminder of how I am in Boston, but not of Boston. As a quote, as W.E. Du Bois said around Harvard, that's how I'm reminded about things like that.
And what happened just reminded you?
It just reminded me again that, you know, I can't get comfortable thinking that I'm safe given the identities that I have, given that I am Black, given that I'm a woman, given that I'm a lesbian, all three of those. Not everybody likes one, let alone all three. And so I knew in saying yes to the portraits that I was putting myself in a position for something like this to happen and that I needed to be prepared for that. But I felt it was worth it to have my photo up there for the hope, perhaps, for a young person who may have some or all of my identities to say, hey, that could be me, and to be able to live as they want to live. So it was worth it for me to do it.
Quincy Roberts, did you see a risk and was it worth it?
Oh, absolutely it was worth it. And Gene can attest to this, that I forewarned him that this would happen about 8 months ago. Just like Sister Beth said, it was the inevitable. Being Black, being gay, being male, all these different identities, being from the South, being very confident and comfortable in my skin. Shout out to Beyonce. We're very comfortable in our skin, and that makes people upset for whatever reason. So I was mentally prepared for it. But when it happened, you know, it was a little emotional, but I was mentally prepared for it because I knew it would happen to not specifically mine, but I knew it would happen. I just didn't know it would happen to me
you.
First.
So, Jean, I'll turn to you. After the vandalism, you wrote, quote, "I've been wrestling with this vandalism for 4 days, trying to decide whether I should give it any energy and address it, but I am at a loss for words, saddened and hurt to my core," end quote. So first, how are you now?
I'm better now. It still hurts a little. Because although I had conversations with Quincy around how do we keep them safe, what is the security plan, and there couldn't be one really because I wanted
outdoors.
It to be on the Boston Common for visibility. But I thought, if anything, people would respect the art, the actual photography, and how beautiful these portraits look. And all that credit goes to John Hewitt, who is the photographer. So I thought, even if they don't feel comfortable with the subjects, with the people, but the photography is stunning. And I thought that would have protected us from any sort of vandalism. But no, on day one, we were faced with the first one. And it was Quincy's, which was sad because it was opening day. His family and friends and colleagues were there, but he couldn't much celebrate because they defaced it with a Sharpie. So we were able to get that replaced in a few days. But much later on in the exhibition, I was faced with, first it was Alia, one of the honoree for the exhibition, was slashed. And people were telling me it might have been the wind, it might have been the fabric got ripped. I wanted to believe that. And then 2 days later, they slashed another set of two and then tried to slash another one of Senator Julian Sears. So it just kept happening. And I was trying to decide, if I talk about it, I don't want this to become what the exhibition is about, because it isn't. Our message is clear that we have real-life heroes right here in the city of Boston. I mean, Beth Chandler and Quincy have done so many amazing work, and I've been in the country for only 10 years, and I've been a beneficiary of these people's work. So in many ways, I wanted to give them the flowers and paying my respect to everything they've done for me and for the city of Boston. So it was sad to see it happening, and I'm trying to feel better about it because I don't want the exhibition to become about the vandalism.
So, Quincy, Jean just said that twice. I don't want the exhibition to be about the vandalism. You nodded vigorously both times. So pick that up.
Okay. So I'm sure you've read my responses to emails. I've gotten about 10 requests to speak, and I chose to speak today because I'm just really tired of the story being about the vandalism, because the exhibit was up for over 30 days and nobody really talked to Gene. And I remember Gene and I having a conversation about the mainstream news not picking it up. Nobody really, like, that we thought that could spread the word picked it up until now. So that's why I'm nodding my head, and I'm like, yeah, it feels kind of icky. That's the word that's popping in my head. It feels kind of icky that we have to, you know, do all these interviews about the vandalism, but it's 22 beautiful portraits there, and nobody seems to want to talk about that and all the work that Gene put into that on his own. Because I remember when he came to me almost a year ago with this idea, and I said, I'm like, not now. We don't have the time. It's just a lot of money to go into this. But Gene persevered and brought this beautiful project to Boston. So I hope that this is like the last day that I have to talk about it. And I even talked about it in therapy. I'm like, why are we talking about negative stuff when so many beautiful portraits that we can talk about, and the individuals a part of this project, and like he said, superheroes. A lot of people I look up to, like Grace Starling, Stowell, and Grace Morano. It's like so many people that are part of this exhibit that are doing amazing things. I really want to just focus on that, as well as take the opportunity to talk about some of the things that Beth is doing and some of the things that I'm doing that is very positive, that is going to shed light. And part two of this Portraits of Pride, when it comes to City Hall Plaza, like, let's talk about the plans to make sure that everybody can see the wonderful work that Gene has put forward.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Quincy Roberts, who's executive director of the Boston Office of LGBTQ Plus Advancement, Jean Dolan, who's creative director of Portraits of Pride, and Beth Chandler, president and CEO of YW Boston. What brought us together was vandalism of the 22 8-foot-tall portraits in Boston Common. What we've just been hearing from Quincy Roberts is wrong reason to come together. The right reason to come together is the pictures themselves. So, Beth, let me turn to you from there. Do you want to talk about those 22 pictures?
I mean, the 22 pictures are beautiful. I mean, the work that John Hewitt did in the photography, I think, really captured the essence of who the people are that were selected. And there could have been, you know, 22 more folks who were selected. But just to the beauty, the joy. And I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about Black joy. There's also talk about LGBTQ joy, right? And the joy and the resilience of the community. And you see that in the confidence that Quincy spoke about that people have. And you see that. And I think that sheds such a light for people. And particularly, again, I go back to young folks who identify as LGBTQ. I mean, it took me a long time to come out. Because I was fearful of what people would do, what people would say, what I might lose. And I've realized over these decades of what I have gained of claiming all of who I am. And so to me, this exhibit is really about claiming all that we are, all that we can be, giving hope to others to do the same. So that's, and somebody asked me, you know, is there going to be a protest? And I was like, no. I don't want there to be a protest because, again, it takes away from what this is about, which is joy and beauty and hope and perseverance. And that's the message that should get out. And that's what should be celebrated. And that's what should have been celebrated in the papers from day one and not this other stuff that has happened on day 29.
So, Jean, these portraits are gorgeous and they're unique. I mean, one of the things that's amazing is that the photographer really captured an essence of each person. But people might picture sort of 22, everybody with their, you know, fist under their chin sitting in a standard studio, but there are close-ups and full body and different coloring and settings and light usages, mm-hmm. and it's interracial, it's multi-generational. And the people, the work that they represent are every corner of who we are as a community. Mm-hmm. One of the things, there were two things that I wondered, and I'll ask them both. The first thing is, an 8-foot-tall picture that is that magnificent is titanic, to use that word with a small t. What made you feel like that titanic representation in a public space was what you wanted to go for?
So I will start by saying, originally the plan was to do all black and white because black and white tends to tell history, captures a lot of emotion until we started doing the photography and realized there's a lot of colors to play with and we cannot lose all the stories that these colors are saying. I mean, even the skin tone, we would lose that in a black and white. And if I'm being honest, we have people of color in this exhibition and I want that skin color to show because it says something. Some of these photo shoot, the shortest one was about 2.5 hours and the longest one was about 7 hours. So John Hewitt and I dedicated our time for about 1.5 months long to capture everybody's souls, everybody's stories and everybody's resilience in these portraits. The decision to make it 8 feet tall sort of came about when we were having all these conversations about removing statues 10 feet tall in around the country. And then it dawned on me, if we are to honor any heroes and people who have given a lot to society, it should be our real life heroes. And so how do I honor these people who are still here with us, but have done so much in a way that put them larger than life because they've done so much. And there are so many other people that I wanted to put in this exhibition. It's a matter of logistics and time and schedule. It would have taken me probably 5 years to get all of them. But that was the decision to say something about how heroic their lives have been and how much they've contributed and what they represent for so many people. There are people who go visit the exhibition who relate to Quincy being a black man who owns his power and owns his place in the city of Boston and do so confidently, beautifully, I would say. And there are people who go and see Beth and say, oh, she was my teacher 5 years ago. And saying, I was part of Beth's program 8 years ago.
At the YW.
So, yeah, so all of that matters to people, and I just wanted that to reflect. So that was the decision for the 8 feet tall.
So you actually answered my second question there, too, which was sort of the number of people, et cetera. So Quincy, I'll turn to you. Do you feel like a hero? Do you feel like you've led a heroic life? And I don't mean that cheaply,
no,
right?
No, I get it. I am a superhero. I tell my son this all the time, and he gave me this little pin that has a little superhero on it. And I do believe in every speech I give, I say LGBT folks or queer folks, we are superheroes, and our superpower is authenticity. So I believe I am a superhero. I'm human. I don't know what my kryptonite is, but I do feel like a hero. I feel courageous. I fear I I'm fearless because of people like Jean and people like Beth and Grace and all the others, Jonathan and Derek, and the list goes on. My husband, Corey, like these individuals empower me to be a hero. Mm. So, yes.
And you, just add is that I've seen the cheap talk of saying, why do gay people think they're so special? It is not just because we gay that makes us superhero. It is because despite how difficult the rest of the world make it for us to live our lives, to thrive and to be happy, we still do it. And when you think of hero characters, it's always been about doing the impossible. And even staying alive for us sometimes feel impossible. Mm. Having an exhibition feels impossible. So that's why we are superheroes, because we do the impossible of staying alive, staying happy, giving Black joy, contributing to a society who consistently remind us one way or another that we don't belong here.
We're speaking with the curator and two of the people featured in the Portraits of Pride exhibit on Boston Common. Quincy, you just said you don't know what your kryptonite is. Beth, I hear from the three of you loud and clear that what thing isn't your kryptonite is an attempt like this to bring this exhibit down with vandalism. Or that's not your kryptonite.
No.
I do find myself thinking, I've known you for a while, Beth,
yes.
And I know that part of your mission is bringing up strong young women leaders.
Yes.
And the call here is to focus on the positive of this exhibit. Sometimes how we handle the negative can be a very positive force as well. So as you've reacted to what happened to your picture, how are you bringing that into your work with young women? And what is the model to set for other? There will always be a need to be brave.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, I think there are many ways that one can handle it. I think for me, it was in part like this didn't happen. It happened to my portrait, but not to me. Mm-hmm. And it says a lot more about the person or people who did this and about what their needs are and how they're lost in some way that they felt that they had to do this. So to me, it says more about, again, the challenges that the folks that did this have than it says anything about me. I mean, that was not me. It's a picture of me. Mm-hmm. But that does not hurt me, does not, you know, it didn't hit me. So for me, it was about how do we move forward and how do I, you know, try to say a prayer for the folks who had that reaction because they're hurting. Like I'm not hurting. And I had wonderful support from the community, from, you know, A.G. Healy reached out, Andrea Campbell reached out, Liz Miranda reached out, a bunch of friends reached out, people I hadn't heard from reached out. So there was an overwhelming amount of support from people and people I didn't even know. So that, you know, was very helpful, that bolstered me. And it also helped me understand that it was important to show that that didn't hurt me. It doesn't hurt us as a community. We, you know, we can get over this and we need to think about the folks who need the support if this is how they're going to react to something like this.
Mm-hmm. So Quincy, in our just a last minute or so, especially since you're the first leader of the Office of LGBTQ+ Advancement in the city, what's the work now?
Oh, the work never stops. So what Jean and this project has inspired our department to do, we wanted to do many grants in the first place, but now I have a battery pack to do more projects and sponsor more projects like Jean. So the department will be rolling out the Beyond Pride mini grants the end of November. And those mini grants are to support projects from individuals that just have a creative mind, that want to create a safe space, whether that's pictures, whether that's PSAs, whether that's the ball scene, because I know a lot of young folks are into the ballroom scene. So those grants are going to support events like that. And what I'm trying to do is find other departments to match me so we can do more. And then last but not least, I'm going to continue to be visible. Someone asked me why I take so many pictures. And going back to Beth's point, visibility is important. I want young folks, men, women, children alike to see us happy, see us smiling, see us joy. So I won't stop smiling. I won't stop taking pictures. And I won't stop posting just joy. So you will see the joy from our department. You'll see us sponsoring more of projects like Jeans, and last but not least, in June, we will be bringing Portraits of Pride back to City Hall Plaza. Well, we'll be bringing it back, but it will be on City Hall Plaza. It'll be bigger and better.
All right. That is Quincy Roberts, the inaugural executive director of Boston's new Office of LGBTQ Plus Advancement. Also with us, Jean Dolan, creative director of the Portraits of Pride exhibit, and Beth Chandler, president and CEO of YW Boston. Quincy and Beth were both 8-foot-tall pictures. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And we are back with our segment, Funny Stuff, where we check in with Boston comedians to talk about, well, funny stuff. And today, it's satire. Seriously. Satire is the straight-faced use of irony or exaggeration to criticize what I would call the nonsensical. It's really hard to do well, especially in a time when some comedians and political observers argue that irony is basically dead. Recently, however, satire made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court in a First Amendment case about an Ohio man who made fun of his town's police department on Facebook. The online publication, famous for satire, submitted an amicus brief and did it in peak Onion fashion. And that got us to thinking, who still does satire and who around here is doing it well? So here to talk with us, our Boston comedians, Bethany Van Delft and Ken Reed. Bethany, welcome back.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Ken, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
So let's start with our favorite Onion headlines, in case there are listeners who don't know what the flavor of this onion is. All right. My favorite, U.S. dentists can't make nations' teeth any damn whiter. Ken, how about you?
My favorite is everyone in improv troupe balding.
And Bethany, what's yours?
Parents explain how affirmative action has destroyed their children's future.
Fantastic. So that's the flavor. And to carry this out a little bit more, I want to read a bit of what the Onion submitted to the Supreme Court. So they made serious arguments about freedom of speech, but in the interest of amicus curiae, which is where these legal arguments get laid out, here's how it began. The Onion is the world's leading news publication, offering highly acclaimed, universally revered coverage of breaking national, international, and local news events. Rising from its humble beginnings as a print newspaper in 1756, The Onion now enjoys a daily readership of 4.3 trillion and has grown into the single most powerful and influential organization in human history. So, Bethany, you were cracking up through that, and it is funny, but that's actually really hard to do, right?
To be funny in that way?
Yeah.
I mean, what they're doing is they're taking what sounds true and just really highlighting the absurdity of the way we speak today, the way we tout our accomplishments and you know, this is the best coffee here. So we do this all the time. We do it in the news. We do it places where we are supposed to be able to trust authority and trust people's expertise are doing the same thing, you know, best coffee here. So it's funny because it sounds authentic, but it's absurd.
Yeah, it's well observed. And I think for satire, you have to understand the thing you're satirizing so well that you can deconstruct it and make something look, feel, and sound exactly like what you're making fun of, but then tweak it. So in that instance, you either over-exaggerate to a ridiculous amount or under-exaggerate to a ridiculous amount. But the issue, I think, now where satire is difficult is that much bravado and lies and just inflating yourself could get you in the presidency. Like, you could say something like, oh, my 11,000-square-foot home is actually 100,000 square feet, and make that in a legal document be like, that. No, that's true. So it's difficult to the levels of exaggeration and the order of magnitude has changed.
So, Bethany, is that why some people have declared that sort of irony is dead and therefore satire anymore is impossible?
It feels difficult. I don't think it's impossible. But, you know, a president that says the inaugural turnout is the biggest of any president ever, and then you see the pictures and there are just like seven people there. Like, that is what satire was. But right now, that seems to be becoming the truth or the fake truth or what it is. So I do think it's harder to be satirical now because we are seeing people being this absurd and claiming that it's the truth. But I don't think it's impossible. And I think it's more necessary now than ever to highlight how absurd this is and how we're going in a direction of, you know, lies being pushed as the truth.
Yeah, it relies on a shared sense of reality. There's a social contract there that we all need to agree on, sort of a base level reality, in order for us to be able to know what's funny or not. You know, if there's 100, like, oh, there's 100 pencils in this box, and they go, no, I think there's 25,000 in there. And I'm like, well, now I can't say there's 25,000 and that would be funny.
Because you can't. Okay, so a couple things. First, we are talking, this is our latest Funny Stuff segment. It's about satire. We have here in our studios Ken Reed and Bethany Van Delft. The look that you see on my face, which is not laughing but sort of shock, is I'm realizing, one, how hard you have to think to even navigate through what is satire and how do you know if it's funny and what do you do when the things that people say all the time would have been what people knew was satire, but now is just people getting away with. I mean, my brain is kind of hurts a little bit. Good news is there's a beer segment later in the show, so I may want that by then.
Drink so, the pain away.
That's right. But so okay. So how do you do satire now, Ken?
Well, I wonder if we need it as much as we used to. So satire is a weapon that you wield against power. It's a punch up humor model, right? And we have other ways of doing that now. And in many ways, so many more are available to so many people. So there's that. But, you know, if you look at something like A Modest Proposal, which, you know, is about we should eat children, and, you know, to illustrate how ridiculous that concept is, there are literally people now who believe that's a thing. So it's
really, Pizzagate.
Yes, exactly. So
never made that connection.
It's really hard to figure out what people will realize is so ridiculous that it's funny. I don't know. I don't know the answer. Yeah. It's hard.
So, Bethany, I'm going to read a little bit here. So, Ken, you made the example of Modest Proposal, Jonathan Swift, 1700s. Here's the full name, by the way, of this article. A Modest Proposal for preventing the children of poor people from being a burthen to their parents or country and for making them beneficial to the public. So, Bethany, I'm going to read a little bit of this because this is sort of like the defining moment in satire.
Favorite thing to read in college.
Really?
Like, absolutely my favorite thing.
Okay.
It just made me die laughing.
So I'm going to read a little bit to you. But my intention is very far from being confined to provide only for the children of professed beggars. It is of a much greater extent and shall take in the whole number of infants at a certain age who are born of parents, in effect, as little able to support them as those who demand our charity in the streets. I have been assured by a very knowing American of my acquaintance in London that a young, healthy child, well nursed, is, at a year old, a most delicious, nourishing, and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked, or boiled. So why did you love that so much in college?
Because it is absurd, but it feels like that is what that class of people, they're on the way to proposing that, you know? There's a reels going around. It's Gwyneth Paltrow preparing some food, and the voiceover has been changed to her delightfully preparing these thin strips of flesh. And it reminds me of A Modest Proposal.
Interesting.
And so I think that satire is still necessary and it's still important. You know, we're not punching up necessarily maybe to political entities, but there are a lot of people that look to Gwyneth Paltrow for advice in homemaking or products or things that we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, people may not know she has a very successful sort of beauty and personal
Goop.
Products line, Goop. Yeah, I was going to say Gloop, but which again, kind of can't make that up, right?
You can register gloop.com
there
and have
go.
A satirical site about Gwyneth Paltrow's business. Right
There's
there.
Somebody out there, go for it.
Yeah, and so watching the video, to me, casts a light on how absurd it is. Some of the claims that she makes, just some of her real tone deafness about what it is to be a mother, an average working mother in the United States. The video really, it's so absurd, but it does make you think about, who is this person that I'm listening to
right,
for
it exaggerates through extrapolation so you can make the original point of how silly something is.
Yeah. Which, again, is a much better definition of satire even than the one that we started with. So is there any, are there any humor sources, especially local humor sources? Again, we're speaking with Kem Reed, Bethany Van Delft, both local comedians. This is our Funny Stuff segment, that you think are doing a good job at satire now? And I'm assuming that memes and social media have a new role to play in this, Ken.
Yeah, I think so. There's one that I love on Instagram called Square One Mall Goth, and it's incredibly micro-local. It's all these very specific memes and videos about stuff around the North Shore, basically. And
Instagram?
Instagram. So specific, but it makes me laugh all the time.
That's so funny because I looked at it after I heard that and I was like, what?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense if you didn't grow up, but it's so dead on. And then things like The Hard Times, which is, you know, sort of the onion for like punk rock and alternative culture. And that nails it all the time, too. And I think stuff's gotten much more niche, like all entertainment, and much more sort of micro-targeted. So that's kind of where we're at with those things.
So we've had the Hard Times guys on the air here. I think back in 2019, it was an anniversary. I'll see if we can link to that article with this one on our webpage. What about you, Bethany?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know anything local, but one of my favorite Instagram accounts is Memes to Discuss in Therapy.
And I like the title.
Yeah, it's just, one is relax, just try to keep your mind organized, and then has a picture that says my mind, and it's just like a warehouse filled with paper files everywhere. So I like it because it's topical. It might address something that happened yesterday with Yay, or it just might, address a way that we're collectively feeling nowadays in the midst of all of this.
So I'm going to turn very serious for our last couple of minutes. I know the both of you heard at least a little bit of the segment that we did before this, which was about defacing of LGBTQ portraits in an exhibit. We are experiencing a huge uptick in hate. Next week, we'll be talking about anti-Semitism, for example. What role can and should satire play in calling out that extremism when usually satire uses extremism, Ken?
Yeah, I don't think it's an increase in hate. I think it's an increase in hateful people who are emboldened and feel like they can be hateful consequence-free. So what satire and humor is to make consequences for them, to ridicule them, to make them realize that their views and beliefs are completely ridiculous and to take away all power and juice from them, basically, by, that's all we have. And that's what should happen.
Bethany, last thought.
That they're ridiculous and unacceptable. That's the most important thing, to make their views ridiculous, but also unacceptable. Right. And I agree, Ken, I was going to jump in and say the same thing. It's not an uptick in hate. That hate has always been there. It's an emboldenedness to go out and express that hate.
All right, so my brain is actually smoking. I think so much, and you've been.
It's true. I can see it.
Yeah. Ken Reed is a Boston comedian, host of TV Guidance Counselor podcast. Bethany Van Delft is a Boston comedian and a regular host for the Moth Story Slams and Grand Slams. We will see you again on the next Funny Stuff. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much
for having us.
So, have you ever had a bourbon barrel-aged double imperial stout? I have not, but it is a thing, and you don't need to be a Cicerone, which is a beer curator, to enjoy a special local brew or our small batch series on beer brewed here in Massachusetts. With over 200 breweries, Massachusetts is increasingly a prime place for craft beer. You know about Sam Adams, maybe you know about Harpoon, but what about Night Shift, Turtle Swamp, Democracy Brewing, Purgatory Beer Company, Wandering Star? They are all brewed in Massachusetts. In the studio with us, Massachusetts Brewer Guild Executive Director, Katie Stinchin. Katie, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also here, Castle Island Brewing Company's founder and Mass Brewers Guild Vice President, Adam Romano.
Good morning. How about
there
that?
There, we've got you. Okay, and Beth Chandler's back from our first segment of the show today because we found out in the kitchen beforehand that there's actually a special relationship between YW and Castle Island Brewing, and we like to have an extra taster in the room whenever we can. So Beth Chandler, head of the YW Boston, welcome back.
Thank you. So happy to taste beer and not talk about the other thing.
There you go. Exactly. All right. So, Katie, I knew that beer was a growing industry in Massachusetts, but I had no idea. So tell us about the state of the industry here in the Commonwealth.
Sure. Yeah, when I started at this job 6 years ago, there were 120 breweries, and today there are 230 operational breweries, with 30 more in planning, slated to open at the close of this year or the beginning of next. So certainly no sign of slowing down at all.
So what's causing that? Is it just demand, or do we have certain conditions here in the state that are optimal or really good for making beer?
I think there's a lot of passion for the craft beer industry. I think there's some shift in, I don't want to work my day job anymore, and I've always been a home brewer, and I love to do this, so they want to open up their own shop. I certainly get calls from every downtown across Massachusetts saying, we want a brewery here. So there's also a lot of, no one's sad when a brewery moves into their town or their city. So I think that there is some demand for that as well.
And Adam, how do we stack up? I mean, there are breweries, you know, up north, down south, east coast, west coast, middle of the country. Does the Commonwealth have any particular reputation in the industry?
Yeah, without a doubt. Massachusetts has actually become known as one of the leading beer producing states in the country, despite being, you know, one of the smallest by landmass. Certainly, we've got a number of the country's largest, most popular breweries, most successful breweries. So we've definitely put our mark on the map.
All right. So we are going to splice throughout this, tasting some of the beers that Castle Island makes. And so let's start. We've been sort of talking about building the industry. Castle Island's been around about 7 years.
That's correct.
So let's start with a standard. This is Keeper, which is your flagship IPA, right?
Yeah, that's okay. Correct. Keeper. All right. Keeper is one of the beers that we opened the brewery with 7 years ago, as a matter of fact.
All right. So open that right up in the mic so everybody can hear what a good cold beer sounds. Oh, yeah. That sounds good.
Never gets old.
No. And while you pour, tell us a little bit more about what an IPA is and how you decided how to make Keeper.
Yeah. So IPAs, they used to be a pretty narrow style, and the category has really exploded over the last number of years. But they're really categorized by sort of a balanced malt profile, but a really pronounced hop profile, whether that's bitterness or flavor or aroma. The IPAs really tend to lean mostly on hops for flavor.
Okay, now am I supposed to, like, taste this the way I, you know, stick your nose in and bring in the bouquet and then swish it all around? Am I supposed to do all of that?
Yeah, you don't have to get science-y with it, but definitely give it a smell and then a taste for sure.
Oh, man. Beth, you were the first to taste, so tell us, what do you think? What are you tasting? What are you smelling? What do you think?
Sure. So I am tasting the little bit of bitterness in the beer, but not too much. Not tasting any sort of malt. Smell, definitely the barley and the hops. But it's a pleasantly drinking beer.
And Katie, fizzy, not fizzy? How do we think about that piece of this?
I would say this is a pretty effervescent beer. Nice little head on it.
So effervescent is the fancy way I'm supposed to say it.
No,
that,
no.
Right?
It's a long way of saying bubbly.
Yeah, you could say it any way you want. We're not too geeky here at the Mass Brewers Guild. As long as you love beer, we're friends.
So, Katie, one of the things that we, and I'm going to taste others, I'm going to pour the rest of my out of this glass into this bowl, so we'll be able to come back for more, because otherwise listeners are going to be like, seriously, Tiziana, it is 11 a.m. So, Katie, we've talked with a lot of industries about how they came through COVID. And I find brewing pretty interesting because, on the one hand, one of the at least anecdotal things that we hear about COVID is that people drank more.
Sure.
Because they were locked at home and, you know, didn't have a social life, et cetera. You also talked about this wave of people saying, COVID changed my perspective. I don't want to do my day job anymore. Mm-hmm. How did COVID affect our Massachusetts brewing industry?
Yeah, and I think that that's a pretty common misconception. Everyone felt like if you were in the alcohol production business during COVID, you were printing money. But unfortunately, that was not the case for our smallest craft brewers who sell the majority of their beer over their bar in their tap room, which
was in their own business.
In their own business.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that's where they, you know, make the most revenue. And overnight, that channel was turned off. And then our biggest customer and our biggest partner restaurants were turned off. And any event venue that you go to that serves beer was turned off. So our breweries had to get really creative during that downtime to become retail centers. And fortunately, we had a lot of amazing craft beer fans get out there, buy four packs, buy gift cards, tip generously. It's the reason that we were able to ride out that storm.
We're talking with Katie Stinchin, who's the executive director of the Massachusetts Brewers Guild, and Adam Romano, who's founder and president of Castle Island Brewing Company, with our guest taster, Beth Chandler, president and CEO of YW Boston. As we look at the beer industry, it's our first brewed in Mass, and we're learning about the size and scope of the beer industry. So, Adam, during COVID, Well, how did Castle Island do, and what were you most worried about? Because as I understand it, it's actually a very tight family community in brewing. What were you worried about most for your colleague businesses?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, the one word that jumps out to me over the last 2 years was pivot. We, as a brewery and a lot of other people did similar things, became a pickup location for CSAs, for local restaurants that were doing home meal kits. So everyone was just trying to find some way to get people in the door. I think, you know, one of the big concerns that we had was what's going to happen to what we call the on-premise, the bars and restaurants, and will they come back? Because it's, for a lot of us, it's our business, but it's also our customers' business. And if we're losing it on both fronts, it gets really problematic. I'm really relieved to see that so many breweries survived that and, you know, have made it into 2022 and will make it beyond, because frankly, when we were on the other side of this thing, it was really hard to tell.
So this is a moment we're going to taste again, and this one is specifically why we have our guest taster, Beth Chandler, here. So we're going to taste a beer called Fiver, which is a hazy IPA, and I just need to confess now, I love hazy IPAs. So I think I'll enjoy this very much. I'm going to pass my glass back. And Beth, tell us a little bit about the relationship between the YW and this beer, Fiver.
Yeah, sure. So Castle Island started, this is the second year, where the proceeds from the Fiver beer is shared with five nonprofits at the end of the year. And so we were fortunate to be selected this year as one of the five nonprofits. They have been wonderful partners. They've had several events for all of the organizations that they're supporting this year, and we've attended several of those. And the receptivity has been wonderful by the Castle Brewer community, the folks that have come to the events. And, you know, other organizations have been able to do other things. They're just really open to wanting to support organizations in any way that they can. So we're really appreciative, and it's a good beer. So it's nice to be affiliated with a good tasting product.
So let's do that part now. Katie, you're our first taster on this one, so give us a description.
It's light, it's citrusy, well-balanced. It's a delicious hazy IPA.
Oh, thank you.
So what marks a hazy IPA? Because there are going to be a lot of people out there who are like, I like Bud, right? Which is one of the most high-selling beers in the world, actually. So for something like this, what attracts somebody to want to try something like a hazy IPA?
Yeah, so the name obviously indicates that visually it's a hazy beer. It's not crystal clear.
Yeah, so you can't see through it. I'm looking at you through my glass. I cannot see you at all.
Correct.
Right.
And it starts there, but some of the other hallmarks of a hazy IPA are very low bitterness. So it's not very aggressive on the palate. And really fruit-forward hops. So they're very citrusy. Sometimes they even get tropical. You can get flavors of peach and mango and papaya out of the hops.
How? They're hops.
Yeah, they are. But believe it or not, they're chemical compounds in the hop flowers that give you those aromatics and those flavors during and after the fermentation process. It's pretty wild.
So, Beth, I'm going to get serious on us again for a second here. What is the opportunity? You know, the YW works on diversity, equity, and inclusion as a key piece of what you do, on future women's leadership. When you have an opportunity to partner through philanthropy like this with a company like Castle Island, what's the opportunity there? We know how they're supporting you, but how can you support them?
Sure. So it's a great question. So last year, I actually spoke at the Brewers Guild Conference, which is happening again in a couple of weeks. And so it was an opportunity to talk about why diversity is important for brewers, right? And it is, when you think about the makeup of the state of Massachusetts and the changing demographics. If you want to be successful, you have to meet the palates. You have to, one, have a more diverse audience, because that's what the population is going towards in Massachusetts, and folks have different tastes. So there's value to brewers to understand that. And then working with Castle Island, we've talked about doing some workshops with them about the work that we do and thinking about how do you ensure that all your employees feel included. And there's a lot of, it's a predominantly male dominated field. And so thinking about what can they do for folks who identify as women or those that are non-binary, how to ensure that they feel included both as employees and as folks who drink beer. Beer is often associated with white folks, not black folks, right? And so how do you make sure that that customers who are people of color feel welcome in breweries? So there's lots to talk about. There's lots that we can give to Castle Island and other brewers about thinking about why does diversity matter? Because it does.
So, Adam, I'm going to give you a complex job here, which is I'm about to ask you a question in response to what Beth just said. But while I start to ask you that question, grab the crooked cow prints, because one of the things Beth just said was people have different tastes. And part of the challenge is to expand sort of the appeal to a wide range of palates. So while you open that up and pour, tell me how you are trying to change Castle Island in response to the things we just heard from Beth.
Yeah, certainly. So Castle Island has always really valued and really kind of tried to build our brand and our community on an inclusive approach. We try to brew beers that are welcoming and accessible. We try to program events that really appeal to a wide variety of people and welcome everyone. You know, we often say internally that, you know, we might not be for everyone, but everyone is welcome here. And it has been a challenge historically for breweries to capitalize on community building outside of the white male community because it has been so white and so male for so long. But after a while, and I think, you know, the maturing of the industry has helped create some tailwinds for us and for other brands that are trying to make a more diverse space. There are more accessible styles out there. Hazy IPA, actually, because of the low bitterness, has been a point of entry for a lot of people into the beer category as a consumer, because it doesn't have the hallmarks of a typically aggressive beer. And it's weird to say that a particular style helps create diversity in the industry, but when you're trying to appeal to different tastes and different preferences, a new style that is kind of coming out of nowhere in the last few years really helps to break down some of those barriers.
All right, so speaking of coming out of nowhere, this is Crooked Cow Prince, which is salted caramel coffee blonde stout in collaboration with JP Licks. I think I'm the first human being to ever say that string of words together in sense before. I'm going to take the first taste on this one because I'm a little trepidatious, not going to lie. Oh my God, it tastes like ice cream.
Yeah. That's the idea.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's a little dangerous because seriously, that doesn't taste like alcohol. That tastes like ice cream.
Yeah, so this is a really cool partnership that we just forged with JP Licks. This beer is going to be starting to pop up in bars and liquor stores throughout Massachusetts very soon. We wanted to put together a flavor for a beer that really kind of reflects the ice cream. And to enhance the partnership, JP Licks also made an ice cream flavor that reflects the beer, mm-hmm. Which you can now get in JP Licks locations throughout the greater Boston area. So really cool partnership working with another very well-known Massachusetts-based kind of consumer brand, but a place that people love and a place that makes people happy, because at the end of the day, we're in the beer business. You know, we're in the business of making people happy.
Do we have a thumbs up from Beth and Katie on
this
one?
This is delicious. I would do a beer float. Bloop, bloop. Just put there a little scoop of ice cream right on top.
We did those last night.
All right. So listen, we have 2 minutes left. Adam, after you get a taste of that, pull out the white ale Belgian beer, please, and at least pour it for Beth and Katie. I'm probably going to close the show out here, so I won't be able to. And Katie, tell us what the imperatives. I mean, you've just heard a pretty robust and complex conversation we've had here. Picking up on that, in the next minute or so, what are the real imperatives now for the industry here in Massachusetts that you represent?
Well, we're certainly facing an onslaught of whack-a-mole issues that seem to be coming up every day, from CO2 shortages to increase.
CO2 is what gives the fizzy, right?
Yes, but it's also a major, majorly used in the production process, pushing product through the tanks. Oxygen is an enemy. CO2 is the solution, so we use it in all of our packaging, purging kegs, purging our cans, making sure that everything stays fresh. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
And inflation, an issue?
Big, big, big time, like 30% increase on all costs across the board. So our brewers are struggling and grappling with a lot of those issues.
Okay, so sip of this one, Katie and Adam and Beth. Let's hear this last one. This is a Belgian beer?
Correct, yeah. So this is our Castle Island White Ale. It's a Belgian-style wheat beer. A lot of people are familiar with a brand out of Colorado, Blue Moon. Kind of a similar style, but this is our spin on it.
Take that, Blue Moon. All right. So Adam Romano, founder and president of Castle Island Brewing Company in Boston. Beth Chandler, president and CEO of YW Boston, a beneficiary of Fiverr and our guest taster today. And Katie Stinchin, executive director of the Massachusetts Brewers Guild. Honestly, fascinating look at the industry and delicious tasting, Adam. Thank you to all three of you.
Cheers.
Thanks so much.
Cheers.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. On behalf of the whole team, thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Tune in Monday for more Radio Boston.